So first, I would like to welcome everybody. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day to join us for this conversation about the pre-schematic designs and the bridge barriers. My name is Dr. Greg Eales. I'm the Director of Counseling and Psychological Services here at Cornell. As all of you know, we will be seeing and hearing about these pre-schematic designs. Our architectural consultants from NADA will be introduced here in a minute. I also want to just briefly provide some context for this. Many of you are aware we embarked this last spring on a means restriction study to really look at the efficacy of this. There are ongoing conversations with the city of Ithaca, with the Cornell community. One of the things that's really important to kind of acknowledge about this is that Cornell, we really have had a long-standing commitment to larger mental health issues. This came up at the morning session as well, talking about the underlying issues of depression, substance use, all those things. All of those things are very important. That's not the purpose of this meeting, but it is important to acknowledge that broader context. You can see our mental health framework, which we've really developed over the last decade, to look at some of these broader mental health issues. These are things we're still in conversations in about and about as a community. At the top of our kind of wheel, as we call it, is looking at ways to foster a healthy educational environment. All of you are involved in those conversations. We have a Council on Mental Health and Welfare that's meeting several times a semester to talk about these issues and involving faculty, staff, and students. We're also looking at ways in residential programs to promote life skills, to promote resilience, other programs we've developed to increase help seeking, various outreach programs, educational programs, finding ways to lower barriers of care. David Scorton was very articulate about that last spring, talking about if you learn anything, learn to ask for help. All of those things are part of those comprehensive messages. Also providing well-integrated mental health care and health care, where at Gannett we're working very hard, as many of you saw in the Cornell Sun, looking at increasing funding for our efforts to really respond to the needs that are out there. We know there are students that need care, that if we add more resources can get that care. So that's definitely a plan Cornell's committed to. Delivering coordinated crisis management. We work very closely with the Dean of Students within the whole Cornell community to respond when there is a crisis. And then the final piece, which really is what we'll be talking about today, are means restriction. And if many of you remember last spring, after some of the tragedies happened, we brought in experts, and they said, you know, they really looked at all of our efforts, many aspects of this wheel, and said, you guys are really doing a good job on many of this. In many ways, other universities are looking to you. The one piece that hasn't been addressed for obvious reasons is means restriction, is some of the physical aspects of our environment and the risk that poses to certain people who are experiencing pain. So we will be talking about some of these broader issues in other meetings in April, but this really is about this piece and about the university's response to bridges and redesigning the bridges. So that's really where our focus is going to be. Another important thing to just be reminded of, in our earlier session, we had a meeting this morning at 8:30 where Dr. Hank Gerson talked about how this isn't just a Cornell issue. This is an issue for the whole Ithaca community. Many people have completed suicides on these bridges who are not Cornell students. So it is an issue of safety for all of us. And the idea really from a psychological treatment perspective is to create some barrier where you can kind of shift the ambiguity and the ambivalence anybody's feeling when they're contemplating suicide. So at this point, I would like to turn the discussion over to our architect, Cornell University architect Gilbert Delgado. Gilbert will be providing you an overview, a timeline of the project, and we'll be introducing our consultants after the consultants' reports. And I do want to just remind you, please hold your question and answers till after the report, because if you ask questions during the report, sometimes it disrupts the flow, and they've already planned to answer some of those questions throughout the presentation. So hold all your questions. There will be a Q&A. I'll be moderating. You'll have opportunities to ask our Cornell University architect as well as our consultants any questions that you may have. So let me turn it over to Gilbert.
Thank you. And thank you for coming today. Okay, all right. What you're going to see today is a design submittal that was designed with intent to foster and facilitate conversation and discussion about different design approaches. We in our contract with OfficeDAW, we talked about a design submittal where there would be three different variations for all the bridges. And the reason why we did that was that we wanted to be sure that we didn't jump to any preconceptions regarding what were some possible solutions. We will see nets, we will see fences, we will see things in between, but what we wanted to do was to facilitate a discussion on exploration, different types of solutions, and then to put those solutions out into the public to garner a response. So going to the overall schedule that you see behind me, we're the little line that says today, well, that's today. So the first part of the work that NADA accomplished was a site survey and research. Basically, what they did was they came to Ithaca, they learned about our culture, they learned about the specifics of the site, they also explored different methods of means restriction, materials, and they'll talk a little bit about that. So there's some boards outside that actually summarize some of those explorations, and I encourage you to take a look at them. The next phase is the one that we're in right now, and it's called pre-schematics. This is before schematic design, which is actually trying to refine some designs for actual execution. But at this phase, we designed it with the intention of being inclusive and to actually put the designs out in the public for comment. At the end of the presentation, you'll see a web address, and we encourage you very strongly to submit your comments. So with that being said, I just wanted to lay the framework as to where we are in the process, what are the opportunities for comment, and where we plan to go. And with that being said, I want to introduce you Nadar Tehrani, who's our architect. One of the things that we did when we selected an architect for this very important project, we approached it from the standpoint of bringing someone into the discussion that would have a very keen sensitivity to the issues at hand, such as the landscape, vistas, the idea of how do you fabricate something that might have a multiplicity of meanings. And I think you'll find that in Nadir's presentation and Dan Gallagher's, I think we hit a home run with who we picked to be a partner in this exploration. So with that, Nadir.
Thank you very much, Gilbert, for the kind introduction. Tom Beresford is also here as our project manager. Dan Gallagher and I are in charge of this project. It's a very important project for us and for you. It addresses a range of issues with a distinct gravity. The infrastructural basis and foundations of this project are certainly one aspect to it, but we're trying to look at this comprehensively. In other words, what are all of the technical, aesthetic, and cultural aspects of this project that can be couched into the question of means restriction? It's so much part of the identity of this campus and of the community of Ithaca that it begins to define the way that you see yourselves through the seasons and through different times. When we first visited the site, I kept asking Dan, what this reminds me of, and he reminded me of kindred spirits, and how this is, in a way, a classic American scene connected to the American notion of the sublime. This element of the sublime for me resonated because it at once underlines the awe and the beauty of the site, but also the imminent dangers it represents. And in a way, this painting captures a great range of emotions and actualities that come with the site.
It's important also to remember that the bridges operate one as a kind of as a family, that each one in the end deals with a very kind of specific local kind of contextual conditions, structural conditions, the span. But in the end, the experience of the bridges as a whole is in a way tied intricately to all of our understanding, our memories of Cornell itself and the city of Ithaca. So as you see, even though it's two gorges, even though the bridges might necessarily be very different when you think of them also in the way in which they work together. And as you cross one, how do you remember that gorge? How do you remember its relationship to a bridge you've crossed, 100 times the year before because you live someplace else? And then in a way, think of these as part of the broader understanding of the university and your experience here.
The purpose of pre-schematic design, unlike other design processes, is almost to elicit a kind of calisthenic process. We need to be able to imagine multiple iterations of approaches sometimes as a series of species and sometimes as distinct problems onto their own, in order to begin to open up possibilities, expand your imagination, and really open up our own minds towards this.
So in a way, you'll see today seven bridges, of which our charge was to investigate, understand, and develop three potential options for each bridge. So on one hand, you'll see 21 different options, which is could be cacophonous in the way in which you see it. What we've tried to do then is to understand the broad potential within the pre-schematic design process, opening it up to the greatest extent that is possible within these kind of within the scenario, and then also then understanding how that begins to get contracted into understanding the family of the seven bridges.
There's a range of technical issues to which we will not speak today, but that are important: snow removal, maintenance, a great range of things that have to do with ergonomics. Here you see a diagram to the left of the kind of universal design standards that maybe designing with American Disabilities Act is not sufficient. We come in different shapes, sizes, and abilities. But these are all things that we're working with, a series of groups to address. But this is a moment where we can talk about design in broader terms and then go back to the criteria that produce these images in the first place in the question and answer period. The ground is a very important aspect of this. Let's not forget that bridges are, in fact, constructed grounds. But don't be fooled. The earth, the landscape, the descent down into the gorges are also constructed grounds. The way in which these grounds are treated, both as natural and fabricated landscapes, are important to you because precisely they are vehicular grounds, they're cultured grounds, and they're, in a way, cultivated grounds. So we must think of this also as a landscape project, not merely as an infrastructural project.
Simply, we put this as the point of beginning. The existing conditions, in this we just show two bridges. More importantly, just to show dimensionally what there is now. And you'll see as we go through the various proposals that there are dimensions associated with each section. So you can begin to register the size, shape, scale of the interventions that we are proposing relative to what there is now. What's also important is to know that the material choices that we make, in a way, are intended to be very clearly and primarily twofold. One, the issues of security and means restriction, and the other being the addressing the overarching desire for vista, for view, for transparency, and for openness in many cases. In some cases, it becomes a frame by which you can even further understand the landscape, but that idea of expansiveness is important.
This fundamental theme of transparency poses one of the distinct contradictions of this project. On the one hand, as security barriers, let's say you need total closure or total envelopment, let's say. But in order to preserve the culture and the ecology of the site, what you want is total openness, complete transparency. And these two forces must not be seen merely as conflicting forces, but things that can be mediated and negotiated.
We've, as the bridges in a way talk to a family, so do the materials that we've chosen for further study. As we were looking at the various properties, the various performances of a range of materials, we've kind of crystallized to three potentials. Some may be more familiar than others. The first being a bar system, or in a way, the more conventional idea of a fence. In this case, the rendering as a vertical steel rod. There's obviously issues of climbability in horizontal systems that we then try and change by using simply the kind of vertical rod. The second is what you might see in places like Rockefeller Center, which is glass. Again, the idea that glass is transparent is the point of departure, and then we then need to understand how glass is not necessarily always transparent. There's reflections, there's potential kind of overlap with what might be beyond coming through. So we look at that in very kind of in one very specific location as the potential, but not necessarily a solution for all.
The third option is a tensile steel mesh that on the top image you'll see as virtually transparent because it's so thin from a distance it seems not there at all. But on the oblique image at the bottom, you begin to see the kind of diamond-shaped mesh from which it's composed. Again, important to note the distinction between these viewed on the oblique, which produce more of a scrim-like condition, and sometimes the frontal view, which produces more transparency. And important to note that most all of the options that we're going to show you today are much more transparent than anything that has been there in the past or is currently there with the amended fences. So there is a distinct sense to push some envelopes in terms of exposing the connection between the individual and the gorgeous, despite the imperative to produce an amplified barrier.
So if you think of the barriers that are there now as using a very conventional system in a very conventional way, what we're trying to do in this pre-schematic phase is to look beyond the convention. That in a way, the material selections allows for those kind of maybe unconventional or more kind of dynamic possibilities that we hope you see and can comment on as we move forward.
The Stewart Avenue Bridge is a classic bridge. It's a combination of a form-active bridge. In other words, you can see the arch, but in fact, it's composed of a truss. It connects the north and south sides of the gorge and is linked by both pedestrian and vehicular connections.
So the drawing on the left, just you'll see, again, this will show up in all the various schemes. We'll just be going through these fairly quickly, just for orientation. The site plan on the left is specific to the bridge we'll be looking at. The green lines indicate pedestrian paths. The dots is either automobile or bus routes. And then you can see the little blue stars are the existing call boxes that we just put on there as kind of markers for the locations of those points of assistance that exist now. The first proposal, and again, there's three proposals for each, looks at that bar possibility, the bar scheme, in a way, at first glance, conventionally, and then understanding how we make subtle changes for what we think are greater effect. So in this case, the bars are, it's a vertical system that's attached to the existing bridge, so that the bridge itself doesn't necessarily change. And as on either at the threshold or the ends of each bridge, the bars are vertical. As you move to the midspan of the bridge, the bars kind of gently kind of inflect inwards. And what it does is it creates a kind of internal threshold within the bridge itself that you know when you are passing over that midpoint of the gorge. What it also does is that, in terms of the way in which the system works, is that at that point of, let's say, greatest danger, the ability to kind of climb a rod which is bending toward you is most difficult.
And this is a classic highway barrier section, in fact. But in this case, it's manipulated mm-hmm. towards, if you like, more artful solutions, however subtle in this case. Here, even the painting of the bars is done in a manner to dissolve, to be quite ephemeral. In the introductions that we made early on in the interview process, we imagined ourselves to be the most successful if and only if our projects were to completely disappear. And a lot of that stealth approach is another tendency that you'll see through a lot of these proposals. From the bottom, you can see the slight veil at the very top of it that bends down, arcs down in relationship to the arch. And it's in a way an upside down arch at the top. Now, another approach to the idea of means restriction is not to put something in front of you, precisely to let the railing be intact so that you can get an open and unmediated view to the horizon, and then only when you look down is there some mesh and some barrier in relationship to the gorge.
So this introduces the idea of a horizontal mesh. The mesh is not tight. So in a way, it's not something that works as a trampoline, that if something falls within it, it actually grabs it more like a spider web than a trampoline. It follows, it's on a strut system. In this particular case, the mesh is then suspended between the struts themselves and attached kind of to the structural elements of the bridge. And the third of the three for the Stewart Avenue Bridge is another kind of iteration of the horizontal mesh scheme. In this case, completely independent of the bridge, that this has four points of contact. Those four points are to the landscape or to the gorge itself. In a way, it's suspended beneath the bridge, allowing the bridge to arch as it does, and then the mesh actually to kind of take on its own shape underneath the bridge.
One of the aspects of all of these gorges, all of these sites, is that they have very different edges. So it's as if you're tailoring the geometry of the mesh in relationship to the rocks, the trees, and so forth, so it becomes a suspended element underneath.
Let's call this the sister bridge to the one Stewart Avenue Bridge is the other. So within this broader family of seven, you begin to maybe see smaller groups. And in this case, the two Stewart Avenue bridges work in a way similarly. One, because they connect circulation paths are quite, you know, quite the same. But also their structure begins to tell you something about the interventions as well. In this case, where the other was an arch below, this is a kind of box truss. So the way we use that is as a kind of basis for the intervention also. The first is very similar to the Stewart Ave Cascadilla Bridge, where it's a rod scheme that actually inflects in the middle. Again, you can see it in a very kind of transparent veil, as Nadir was describing, on one hand, and on the other, let me see if I can hear, you see the end of it as a vertical rod that then inflects as it moves to the middle and back.
One thing also to point to now in anticipation of other schemes that will show up is that whenever you have a pedestrian and vehicular bridge, you're actually creating two barriers in one. In other words, the forces of protecting a car going over the edge of the bridge are different than a human being. So the thickness that you see at the base, in part, is due to the forces of a barrier needed for a car. And the verticals are those things that are needed so that there's no climbability for a human being. An alternative scheme is to create a kind of cupped catchment. In reality, in all of our analysis, we did vaulted conditions, vertical wall conditions, canted conditions, and then finally flat conditions. This is one test to see if we could create a catchment that, in a way, bows down if somebody were to drop into it and make it very difficult to climb out.
From the bridge itself, there's very little presence because, again, it exists all underneath the deck of the bridge. So the view is that from the bridge itself is akin to what there is now or before the fences were erected, the stopgap fences. What happens below, then, is understanding this not only the structural implications of a box truss, but also the visual conditions of a box truss. So what you see here are the struts of the new mesh.
It is hard to really see those struts because, in a way, they become encrypted and enmeshed in the very structural system itself.
So in a way, it becomes part of the filigree of the truss below. And the third is a much more, let's say, geometric or, in a way, boxed or rectilinear truss-derived scheme where, again, a horizontal mesh is attached, in this case, with struts to the box truss below. The view from above, again, unimpeded.
And this scheme is similar to the approach that is being undertaken for the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge, where a horizontal system is suspended by a rod and can even fold up in relationship to maintenance and other issues. Maybe of all of the bridges, the Thurston Avenue Bridge is the most complicated, the most complex, maybe the most with the most potential, maybe the most problematic. It has a range of possibilities that open up a great range of possibilities. Its connection to the campus and the community and the dormitories, and the width of the bridge, the width of the sidewalk in particular in relationship to the road, gives it urbanistic possibilities that bring up the possibility of a bridge not as a conduit between A and B, but as a destination itself?
Part of the complexities of the bridge are the visual, let's say, barriers that exist on the bridge, not necessarily the fencing, but the bridge itself, where you have this very large arching member above you, and the rail itself is doing double duty. It's actually the guardrail, but also the automobile rail. And in a way, it creates a density at the edge that prevents you, and I think, again, the rail, as Nader says, is at about at eye height, in a way prevents you from kind of getting the broader vista possible.
The first scheme that we undertake is something that echoes and extends the logic of the double arch. Remember, there's an arch below the bridge, there's an arch above the bridge, and the mesh is seen as an extension of that very logic. Thus, when you see the mesh and the arches together, they look organically coordinated with each other, not an afterthought, but something that is conceived and tied to the very visual logic of the arch.
And part of this as well is the proposal of removing the automobile barrier, from that edge condition as well. So what you see here then is the removal of that very large, very kind of heavy guardrail at the end. The automobile rail is moved inboard to the curb line, and then what you then have between sidewalk and view is just a very shallow curb to hold the mesh.
Now, in a lot of these schemes, you'll see very diagrammatic approaches to the various elements. But snow removal will probably have us designing a kind of mediated base so that one can establish a much more brutal relationship with the ground and then a much more ephemeral relationship with the wall condition.
The second of the three proposals, similar to what you saw on the Stewart F. Falls Creek, where, again, it's a structure that exists below the existing kind of horizon line of the bridge itself. It's attached as a horizontal mesh to the existing structural system. So the view that you see then here is unimpeded from or undifferentiated from what there is now.
But important to distinguish from the previous view. Notice that in this view, the existing railings are there, so they tend to block the view much more than the mesh that is vertical.
And you can just see it as a horizontal line here underneath.
One other opportunity that we discovered was, given the fact that this could be a place and that it could, and given the environment, the weather, the idea that one could create a relationship with the history of New England, the notion of a covered bridge produce the possibility not only of making a place on the bridge, but extending that into the landscape and connecting it back to the campus and the various locations. The canopy here extends beyond its realm and becomes actually a handrail as it extends into the landscape. It is, in effect, an eyebrow to the bridge.
So you see on each side engages the edge condition a different way. On the west side, it extends out around toward the architecture building, and on the east side, up and around the curve and toward the residential quad. In a way, making a place of not just transition, but a place to be and a place of shelter.
A detailed view of the section on the left shows how the car barrier protects the cars on the left side, while on the opposite side, it could transform itself into a bench, and people can sit there and actually look over into the gorge. From underneath the canopy, then, is a protected environment, a place where the view is more classically framed, if you like. The stone arch bridge is unique unto itself. Its technology is different. Its span is different, it's quite tight, its relationship with the urban fabric is quite immediate. It actually was the first place where I came into contact with the gorge, not realizing that I had arrived, actually. And it's also less compromising, if you like, in terms of additions.
It's important to realize with stone arch, it's the shortest of the spans that we are looking at. it's one of the wider of the bridges. So in a way, that compaction actually brings the two sides of the gorges together, as Nader was just describing, in a way, linking those much clearer. The first scheme, again, this is where we look at the potential of glass. That if, in this way, in this case, the desire, because of the kind of iconic character of the bridge itself, to do a as transparent a system as possible, the importance of glass or the ability of glass to do that, understanding that there are that there is reflections and other ways in which you see things beyond the glass. But in this case, you see the glass on the far side as being more transparent as it would be as you approach it more frontally, and on the right side, as you get closer to the oblique, is when you get more of the reflection on the outside. This proposal shows the glass panels as individual panels separated by about 4 inches, so that there's a reading of a kind of solid void relationship, or in this way, glass void relationship as you move through. So it's not a continuous surface, that there's ways in which breeze can come through without necessarily trapping you inside.
Now, naturally, the glass is an approach that we could have undertaken to other schemes also. So in a way, we invite you to interpret schemes across mm-hmm. bridges. But glass being, relatively delicate, probably inviting more maintenance, we've tried to locate certain options with more appropriateness, if you like, to certain schemes.
The view from below very clearly without any change.
We have tried almost in every scheme to produce horizontal mesh schemes that are more sutured, if you like, to the geometry of the gorge and unconnected to the bridges, and this is one that we tested in Proposal B.
So in a way, this scheme actually, as we were describing in earlier bridges, is not connected to the Stone Arch Bridge at all. It's connected to the abutments on either side in 4 points, creating a kind of, again, a net or a web below.
It's not uninteresting at a figurative level, because you can see then that the tensile element that holds the mesh together is a kind of counterfigure of the stone arch itself.
The third is a variation on that, where you actually use the arch almost as a kind of point of stitching itself. So in this case, you have a single kind of tensile member across the gorge on either side, and then the inside edge is in literally kind of stitched to the arch itself. In a way, then, that the surface, maybe a little difficult to read within the image, actually starts fairly horizontally and then dies down into the ravine on either side.
But it points to the fact that there are no generic solutions to any of these bridges. The form of the bridges, their structure, their relationship to the site produces very different interpretations. Of the various bridges, the trolley bridge and the BB Dam bridge give us opportunities for different types of investigation. First, because they're not vehicular, so they give you a different kind of freedom with respect to the hardware and the scale of the bridges. But also, they produce a different sense of scale, a kind of remoteness in the woods, and the question of what would it be like to produce a pavilion, a space of reflection in the woods.
Well, in that case, you could even think of it as a room. What is it? How can we use the scale or the intimacy of a bridge, of a pedestrian bridge, as a way of creating another kind of enclosure, another kind of room within within the landscape?
This keeping in mind that the existing railings are quite thick and quite tall. So what would it be to create a more safe barrier, something that envelops you more, but in fact perceptually is less present? And we started again with the classic highway overpass vaulted system. In this case, extended taller, made much more transparent, and also distorted and bent in a vertical rod system that becomes seating and bench at the base of it.
So referring back to the Stewart Avenue bridges, where we start with a vertical, as you get toward mid-span, it begins to inflect. In this case, the width of the bridge is much narrower. So when that inflection happens, these two can kiss at the top. And when you get to mid-span, in this case, what we're proposing is you actually make an oculus. So right at that mid-span point, it opens up, closes back down, and then opens up as it gets toward the edge of the bridge.
Now, at the edge of the site, where the bridge meets the ground, there is a landing. And that landing, we've also extended the logic of the rails so that they engage the landscape, almost as if there were twigs extending into the field of the earth. Keep your eyes on that, because in future images, we do two other interpretations of that, as an area of congregation or seating, but also another version where you see the extended, the existing railing. The sense of a shift in scale is an important one. Again, a very ephemeral view of being in the forest, the logic of the trees having a kind of distinct impact on the character of the bridge, and then a kind of inlay of wood on the right side that makes it more comfortable for seating. And then the vault as seen in relationship to the trees, the twigs, and the landscape. Now, if the rod system suggests a singular logic of a series of compressive rods that repeat themselves in variation, a compressive and tensile system could be optimized by using triangulation. In this case, the triangular rods are steel and compressive in nature, and mesh is then drawn in between them to produce a much more ephemeral result.
The ability, the triangulated systems are incredibly efficient, and in a way can minimize, in using such a system, the diameter of compression or tensile members across across the length of the proposal.
The landing here is designed precisely in contrast to the bridge itself, as a framed area, a miniature courtyard or a plaza with benches as a threshold into the landscape. And then the connection between us and the landscape is very distinct, because right now the railings go up all the way to here, blocking the view of the ravine precisely. So bringing that line down to the ground and then creating a frame as part of the triangulated system.
It's important in all of these, we maybe should have said earlier, that the system, the mesh system that we've been looking at or that exists, is extraordinarily strong. That it has, you know, it has a very kind of strong tensile strength. So the idea that it can be used as a barrier, as a guardrail, per se, is well within its means. There's varying degrees of openness and closeness. There's smaller and larger diamonds, depending on how you use them, and smaller and larger gauges of wire that you can use as well.
And then as viewed laterally, of course, the triangulation of the compressive members get lost in the kind of dancing of the branches in the woods. A third system uses tensile and compressive members on the vertical and horizontal axis, working with their natural logic to create a frame.
This is a hybrid of a tensegrity system, if any of you know, where the compressive members don't ever touch themselves. You use the mesh or the tensile strength of the mesh as a way of holding them either apart or distant so that you actually can make space within.
In this image, we've resisted from transforming the entry court into anything because we wanted to show the distinction between the existing railings and the new ephemerality that we're introducing into the site. So the actual railings have a very thick section with thick bars. And as you go to the next slide, you begin to understand the delicacy and the softer touch that this brings to the view. The Beebe Dam Bridge is very interesting because of all of the sites, of all of the bridges, it's the one that underlines the asymmetry of the context in a much more clear way. In other words, the dam side really emphasizes the horizontalness of the water beyond, whereas the gorge side emphasizes the vertical. And that asymmetry can begin to get mapped or charted in the section that you see on the left. In other words, one side may be a standing up railing edge, the other side may be a bench. The vault may get biased to one side or the other, but it begins to cite that the idea that bridges don't have natural symmetries. They are designed. There's an artifice connected to them, and this is a moment to take advantage of that.
So if, in a way, again, of this larger family, one thinks of, or we think of Bibi and Trolley as like brother and sister, where there are great similarities in terms of their scale, their distance, but as Nader says, there's quite different in terms of how they actually reach into the landscape or need to address the landscape in specific ways.
It's also important in this image we did not extend the logic of our bars into the immediate landscape in the foreground. So there's a big difference on the upper side as you see it go extending beyond there versus this. So we had imagined that in many of these schemes, there's a more delicate way of connecting it back to the ground and to the pathways.
Thanks.
And here, you can see the relationship of the vertical bars even to the cascading of the water beyond there. The verticality of the striations can be seen here in the distance with the kind of subtle ribboning of the bars.
And in a similar way, in the triangulated system that you saw on Trolley, in this case, being explored in maybe a much more kind of dynamic way, as Bibi extends into the landscape, how can we use that same the efficiency of the triangulated system to give you that sense of kind of continuity into the landscape? The broader spans of this system actually happen at mid-span, and then compresses at the threshold of the bridge and expands again into the landscape. With the ability in some cases literally to remove, as you see in the top right corner, the mesh altogether. So kind of within, let's say, a fairly translucent veil, that there even can be kind of openings made within it to give you greater transparency.
The suspension bridge is maybe the most delicate, the most vulnerable, the most classic experience of the Cornell to Ithaca trajectory. It is the one bridge that, because of its suspension system, is vulnerable to people jumping onto the structure itself, pulling themselves up, and leaping over. But to add other protective means to enclose that adds weight to the bridge. And this is the one bridge, as you well know, that trembles as you walk on it. So if you put something on, you have to take something off. You don't want to add substantial added structure to it. So the kinds of negotiations you'll see in the coming images address the kind of aesthetic and structural challenges all at once.
The first is a mesh scheme which uses the transparency of the mesh to actually open up the view even farther. In this case, by the removal of the steel bars altogether, so that the mesh, as we were using, as you saw in Thurston, as the guardrail, in this case, the guardrail extends up and over, using the tensile members of the bridge itself as that point of closure above you. In this case, that closure happens at mid-span, and again, as in similar in similar instances of other bridges, it opens up as it gets closer to the edge and really just becomes more of a guard toward the end.
So in fact, the truss here provides a foreground for the view, but it eliminates all of the vertical bars that are currently there. And then you can see the subtle shade of the mesh as it vaults up in relationship to the counter-vaulting of the suspension rods down. A second scheme works with the very bars that are there right now, but it acknowledges that we need more height. But it does it in a dual system. In other words, it has a guard system that comes up to the existing truss height, but extends at another dimension up higher beyond that, such that one cannot climb it, and vaults down and bends out in relationship to it.
So in the scenario, the current density of bars is what you see at the truss level and below. And that continues across across the bridge entirely. Above that, then, every other bar is removed and extended to create that kind of, again, the higher enclosure at midspan. And again, as it inflects out as you move toward the edge of the bridge. See the next slide? Previous slide. As you move toward the edge of the bridge, the bars begin to inflect out, opening up to the ends.
And finally, another scheme which has the mesh as an independent system. And ironically, by doing that, the vertical bars that are there now today will remain there in their kind of dense vertical organization. And then the mesh underneath is then tailored to the geometry of the gorge below. With that in mind, we open discussion. We see any format of discussion, obviously, because these are ideas only. This is a pre-schematic phase. And the idea is to use these avenues of thinking to open up discussions.
So we'll take questions now. I believe we have microphones. Someone would like to open it up with a question. Go ahead, up here. Go ahead, right here.
Hi. I guess I could address this to Nader, whomever. So in regards to various schemes that had the mesh beneath the bridges, I was wondering how much thought was put into considering what would prevent people who jumped and landed on the mesh from going further. Because there are various schemes that were horizontal. What's the climbability of those meshes?
As I was describing earlier, more in the more vertical format, the meshes are not a taut surface. There's very little tension.
What was that? Had a question?
I'm sorry.
If you put the address back up, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. In doing so, when one or anything falls into the netted surface, it actually works like a spider web, where it's very, very difficult to maneuver out of. That the more, it's one of those systems that the more you try and grab, the more you try and move, the more enveloped you become.
There's another response that one could add to this, and that is that these are preventive barriers, they're means restrictions, and part of that emerges out of a study that demonstrates that a good range of survivors of suicide attempts actually say that the moment that they jumped was the moment of regret. In other words, that this is a kind of delay in that action, so that when people land, actually, there is a kind of reconsideration of their very situation. And it also can work in relationship to other sensors that as people go off the bridges, there may be an emergency alert for a crew to come and help them, in fact. So I think that we must bear in mind that any of these design solutions are not solutions in and of themselves. They are part and parcel of a larger wheel, as it were, that the school is considering.
Let's take a question up there.
As one part of this larger wheel, in your February presentation that was, the video was provided online, you expressed your concern about the efficacy of these point solutions, and you seem to have addressed that in some of these extending barriers along roadways or along the former hydro plant, but has there, and maybe like you said in the beginning, this isn't necessarily the forum for this conversation, but has there been more discussion about the architect's concerns about these in large, in light of a more comprehensive.
So are you referring to areas around the edges of the gorges? Is that?
Or the fact that the two gorges themselves are these largely linear systems that, you know, the bridges just crossing them at these points have, you know, greater concerns for for action.
I don't know, Gilbert, if you want to respond.
One of the things that we'll be doing in the next stage of design, and we've already begun that, is to document the condition between the edge of the abutment and when the other system, which is the black fence system that currently protects the gorge or protects the people from the gorge, and we'll be documenting that and be folding that into the subsequent design phase. Depending on what alternative we go with on any one of these bridges, that dimension could be different. So we are currently documenting that condition, and that will be part of the next design phase. Thank you.
Well, let's take one down here. Can you get her maybe the mic real quick? There you go. Go ahead.
Hi. I was excited to see some of the newer designs for the Thurston Avenue Bridge. And on option C, where you're creating a roof overhead and also the inclusion of the curb barrier. I was curious what your thoughts about materiality, what some of your material choices, or what some of those options could be, based on the schemes that you showed.
Again, we're at a very pre-schematic phase right now, but we are very much invested in a discussion about materiality, as you can imagine, that. There is nothing off the table right now. Obviously, from a point of view of cost and the maintenance and all of that, there's going to be a whole range of issues that will be discussed, snow removal. But the notion that asphalt is part of the road system is something we will work with. The idea that one can work with either precast concrete elements is another possibility. The notion that one can work with granite as barrier systems or even brick. But these really need to be coordinated with different constituencies. Part of these surfaces, if you like, are cultural. Part of them have to do with maintenance culture. But I think the idea that these are not merely drawings, but they're experienced and they're tactile systems is very much what we're interested in. And they're really part of the frame for the view beyond, not only on the urban axis, let's say, but also on the natural axis. So I think that this is very much a welcome discussion as we go forward into the schematic and design development phase. But it's very
much... Two things we had looked at and probably didn't show up so well in the renderings was creating the underside of the roof as a liner. And in this case, a liner we were showing as a kind of ebonized wood. So in a way, it gives a bit of a kind of warmth or texture to the underside or the protected side of the roof itself. The other thing to keep in mind is the way in which what we're showing is not unlike, let's say, this table, except in our case, the column is moved as close to one edge as possible. Structurally, what's that mean is that this edge, which is, again, closest to the roadway, is going to want to tip over. What we're able to do with the mesh itself is use the tensile potential of it as a way of counteract that bending. So what you can get away with is a much thinner column, a much thinner profile here. And again, the mesh becomes that surface that actually ties it all together. So in a way, the materiality is something that you can push toward a kind of minimal intervention, but still create a maximum effect.
There are other details you may have just noticed that this is the beginning of that. You know, at the end, you know, bridges are large industrial artifacts, and we need to be robust about the language of the parts that we're working with. But that's not necessarily indicative of those moments where we have tactile relationship to them. So we could introduce wood guards or wood rails, areas that are, let's say, more warm or more in touch with the ground. So I think as we go forward and we begin to understand at what point is heavy machinery going to come into contact with curbs and things, and at what point are humans going to come into contact with them, you may see an interesting tension between a more softer and a more harder touch.
So we had a question up here.
So One thing that I just found a little curious in the presentation is you talk a lot about the view out from the bridges, but I was also just struck by the fact that you never mentioned the view down from the bridges. And as a student here and being in the area for a while, I know a lot of people also take pictures down and look down. So I was just curious if that was something that was considered and just didn't get brought up in the talk. And then also, some of your designs take away the barrier that's there currently and then just puts up the tensile mesh structure. And I was just wondering if you considered like people with fear of heights or something, would that potentially be a barrier for people then walking across the bridge from that? So kind of two parts there.
I think it's a good question. We've gotten it in previous meetings and we got it in the meeting this morning. And I take lead on answering that because I'm the one who has the biggest fear of heights. And I think it's an important question, actually, because part of the this is one of those moments in a design process where you radicalize a certain set of possibilities to demonstrate the extremity of the openness, but that's not necessarily what you really want. So to share an anecdote with you, I am a skier, and I can ski black slopes, and I'm not afraid of the steepness of these slopes, and I don't know why, but I discovered I'm not afraid when there's a foreground, like a mogul, to the distant view beyond. So if there's a rock right here between me and the precipice, I'm okay with it. When there's me and nothing, then I'm completely frightened. And I believe that the bridges produce that foreground for you. So when we do an unmediated edge, I'm one of those people that would be more afraid. But when we do the schemes that have the curbs or another thin railing, it produces a kind of tactile moment, but an optical moment that also gives you that kind of visual leverage. So, and I think these are the kind of nuances that certainly will come out in the design development process. But if you also noted that there are, each of these bridges has actually a very different relationship to looking down than out. For instance, the Stone Arch Bridge originally was had a railing height that was this high. That didn't fulfill the necessary code requirements for guards. So the actual lintel, there's another piece of stone that was set there that brings it up to guard height. As it turns out, it's actually a very deep deep element. So I actually had to go over like this to look down, which is hard to do. So in fact, if you want to do it, you can do it, especially on the schemes that produce the horizontal mesh. But it's a lot of people have come up with very different, in a way, analysis of that in the various meetings we've had. Some people said, well, it's good to set up some kind of barrier, and other people want less of a barrier. But I think it's a nuanced discussion. People generally have stated they want a more open feel, but they also want to feel protected. And how we calibrate this is going to be an important set of issues for the design development.
One thing you'd said in an earlier meeting was that the mesh becomes pretty invisible.
That's right.
At a 15, 20-foot distance. So.
Right.
One follow-up question.
I guess maybe I didn't understand the answer to your question, or maybe I should have asked what I asked in two parts. I guess the first part, though, being, was there consideration of the view down as much as the view out? I guess I don't really feel like that was addressed. And then also I will just say, I know people who won't walk across this suspension bridge because of their fear of heights. So, you know, and that's one that's particularly long and narrow, but I'm thinking, you know, on another bridge like the one by College Town, having that little edge where you can look down, I know would be, for people with severe fear of heights, much worse. So.
The answer is yes, we did consider it, but we also considered it in relationship to the range of responses we've gotten from a variety of constituencies. In that sense, we've tried to provide for, let's say, visions that are more solid and more porous. And this is that moment where you get a more extreme view of some of these. Some of these are much more porous to the point that it seems that there's nothing there. And some of them are more mediated because the vertical bar systems, for instance, give literally a surface so that one feels protected, one feels enclosed. And certainly it's something that we would gauge on a bridge-by-bridge basis.
Other questions? This gentleman over here. There's one in the back.
This might be more. This is more of a question maybe for the mental health directorate. So this past month in the Journal of Social Science and Medicine by Dr. Garrett Glasgow of the University of Santa Barbara, it says that, in fact, most of the conclusions of the previous study were not correct, that there is no way to measure the impact of local landmark bridges on means restriction for suicide jumping sites, that that does not, in fact, reduce the incidence of suicide within a municipality, and that, in fact, measurement as such might be not really possible given limitations of study. Is that...
We're going to have additional meetings in, throughout April to talk about means restriction as a philosophy, and looking at Dr. Glasgow's study from UC Santa Barbara. I mean, one of the things, it was a correlational analysis that looked at overall county suicide rates and found no relationship between various barriers and decreasing the county suicide rate. Will these barriers decrease the county suicide rate? Probably not. What we're looking at with means restriction is shifting from some of these more lethal means, like Nadar said, also providing that impetus, so there's not that impulsivity. And it is only one study. As many of you recall from last spring, there are other researchers that really are looking at this, and there is indication that it is effective. So the science is still out on that, and I think that's a piece that's important to acknowledge. Another piece that's also important to acknowledge that is not mentioned in the Glasgow study is the issue of social contagion, and how when these high-profile events do have a much higher social contagion impact on the larger community. An issue that came up this morning was also the kind of traumatic effect that occurs to the larger community witnessing these very high-profile suicides. So those are things that are definitely not even addressed or scratched upon in the article that you just cited.
The page that was set up by the VP for Student Affairs last semester had one study cited. There was one footnote on that page.
Annette Boutre's articles were cited on that, yes. So, there's still ongoing research on this, and most of the research on means restriction, the best research has been done in the last 5 years. So we will continue to have kind of ongoing conversations about that, but this is really about the pre-schematic design, so.
Well, I have another question about that, then, in regards to, is there any possibility at all of just not building these?
We're still in conversations with the city. I mean, this is part of the ongoing process. It's not as if a decision has been made yet, so the conversations are still ongoing. It's up to leadership at Cornell and the Common Council. So, yeah.
I'll get one back there. I was intrigued by some of the various net designs, especially those that are below the level of the barriers, the walk barriers, and so on at the edges of the bridges, and that these nets apparently can be rather difficult to struggle in. You're sort of caught in the nets, the way they function. How easy or difficult is it then to rescue such a person for the emergency personnel that would come? These people are obviously several feet below the bridge, and I'm sure there's probably some kind of way to do that. I just went having a little trouble envisioning it.
The studies that we do know are specific to the work they're producing at the Golden Gate Bridge, in which they actually have a person in a harness actually lower themselves over the side and to help disengage someone from the mesh itself.
A couple questions up here.
Hi, after listening to your presentation, I still couldn't help but feel that your proposals remain somewhat two-dimensional. And you do begin to introduce this volumetric aspect into the design of these fences, but I still feel like it reads more as a surface through space rather than something that creates a new space. And in a way, I'd be interested in seeing some proposals that really acknowledge the structure and texture in these fences, because the idea that I get is that you're almost denying the existence of these things that you're putting up. I'd be really interested in seeing something that like acknowledges this issue, because almost in a way, by making these so transparent, you're sort of pushing this issue to the side, I feel, almost saying like it doesn't exist. But I'd be really interested in seeing something that says, okay, this is a fence, right? And then begin to layer it and begin to introduce this volume and make it something that isn't so much a boundary, but something that's more spatial.
Such is the conundrum of the design, I would say, is that where do you strike the balance between ephemerality and presence? And in this case, the views that we choose, the materials that we choose, the bridges that we choose to pursue certain materials or certain options, we're trying to understand what the range may be. Again, in our case, we have maybe always, and we maybe need to reconsider this, we've always kind of prejudiced the idea of openness or transparency as very critical to the way in which one understands the landscape of Cornell, and in particular the gorges. But again, it's an ongoing design process.
I'm not sure if I'm understanding exactly the point of view of the question, but I would say there's a distinction between presence and ephemerality on the one hand, and the question of two-dimensionality versus three-dimensionality. A railing, a common railing, if you like, is a surface. But that railing viewed as part of a section of a road becomes spatial by the way in which it frames space. A two-dimensional sheet of paper, well, is two-dimensional. The moment you introduce a dart into that paper and reconnect it, it becomes a conical surface. That conical surface, by definition, is spatial because it can no longer be defined by two-dimensionality alone. It becomes a spatial envelope. A good portion of the majority of the schemes we presented today are the result of both conical as well as compound formal conditions. I'm now speaking in geometric terms, which means that they are in fact very spatial in that they are thinking not so much about the surface, but actually the entire container of the bridge as a space. This is not so much to challenge your question, but it's a kind of genuine engagement in trying to escape the two-dimensionality of the conventions of bridge making as railings. So if we were unable to convey that, we may be falling short of the potentials of spatiality and would welcome, in fact, more discussion about that. The other thing that you bring into mind, which for me is a personal interest, which is not so much part of the scope of this work, though I very much want them to make it part of the scope, is that to stop seeing these bridges as objects, but really as extensions of landscapes, that the campus landscape, the city landscape, the infrastructure of the roads, the walkways, the landscape, the sidewalks, the paths, all of these are spatial continuums that of which the bridge is a part, and I'd like to see these conceptualized as extensions of that landscape. That for me is also a spatial problem, but maybe at a more territorial scale and less so much as a surface of that thing that, you know, begins and ends at the beginning and end of the bridge. But just some thoughts in relationship to your comments.
Other questions? Another question right here.
In terms of, I think, specifically, this is regarding the trolley bridge, proposal A, I believe, which is the, right. So, yeah, there's been, I guess, a lot of discussion, I guess, amongst my group friends is that when the fences are up, it feels as if you're in a cage, almost like a prison. And I was wondering how much consideration was placed when you put up the rods, if those would end up feeling more like a cage because of the way it angles over to a point.
ongoing study, in a way, how much of enclosure brings you to that point, and how much is enough to understand you are inside and yet not enclosed? And I think the way in which we try and start either vertical or even beyond vertical, bring them together, touch, open, touch, and then open again. We're trying to find that line between the amount of openness, the amount of enclosure, which is, you know, in a way evocative of the feeling of being in a space within a broader space, especially Trolley, where the idea of making a room, which is actually already an existing room if you think about the trees themselves. In that case, the canopy of the trees makes a much larger scale space. Can we then bring that into the intimacy of the bridge itself without necessarily feeling as if you're somehow, you know, brought together?
Another perspective one could bring to your question is really a cultural question. Was it not the same technology that produced the metal work for Art Nouveau subway stations and prisons at the same time? But in fact, the effect, the character, and the tactility of one and the purpose of one and the other are quite different, of course. And the attempt here, at least at the level of these studies, at a very preliminary level, is to bring to a hardware that's actually quite industrial and hard, a sense of organicism, a sense of program by, you know, making them usable as benches and rails and so forth, and to make them purposeful in both a structural sense and an ornamental sense. Here, erasing the traditional interpretive boundaries between necessity and ornament, between structure and surplus. So in a way, we're inviting more readings of ambiguity rather than, obviously, the conventional readings that we cast onto highway barriers, which are, frankly, just barriers. So again, this is the beginning of that kind of discussion, working with systems that are part of them conventional, part of them less conventional, but give them associations which are precisely not part of the conventions of preventive architecture.
Another question in the back?
The question about the trolley bridge reminded me that I wondered if you could speak for a second about the scope of work, because of we've talked about the 7 bridges, but there actually is an 8th bridge, which is the one at Route 366 behind the Sholkhov Stadium steps, which I believe is a Cornell bridge. That is a fairly short span. It's not particularly deep there, but I'm reminded of that bridge because the trolley solution seems awfully over-designed. It's a very design-intensive approach to a bridge that's very, very small and where the depth, as I recall, isn't very, it's not very deep there. And I think also statistically, I'm not sure anyone's ever jumped off the trolley bridge. So if you could just speak about the trolley and then also the bridge that is not part of this study.
We got that question earlier this morning, one of the earlier sessions, and thanks for that question. Early on, before we got started, that one bridge we're talking about was excluded from the study just because it seemed to be of a different category in terms of risk. The discussion that we will still have is in the next several weeks is precisely that one. In the case of the trolley bridge, you know, is it worth investing this type of effort on that if in fact it is of a lower risk? So our focus here and the reason why we contracted NADA to look at all 7 was just to have those possibilities elaborated as part of that decision-making process. But I think this next has to go through a filter in terms of are there bridges that may be dropped from consideration.
We would like you to think that a certain thinking that's happened on one bridge is in fact transferable to another bridge. Not in all circumstances, of course, but in the case of, let's say, Trolley and Beebe, that may certainly be more of the case than say, Stewart and Stewart. But there is some wisdom to beginning to understand that part of what we do as designers is typologically based, and therefore is transferable from one location to the other. And part of what we do as designers are precisely site-specific, because you understand the cultural significance of this material, this site, this location, this time. And so part of this discussion is really identifying criteria and priorities, and that helps us a lot.
Other questions? All right, well, if there are no other questions, I think we can conclude for today. I just want to remind you again of the website. If you would like to email in your comments, we are collecting those. So any thoughts, any suggestions about this process, please feel free to do that. Again, I want to thank you for your time. I think we are all committed to making our community as safe and beautiful as possible. So thank you very much.